Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by President Obama that the U.S. will be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine that the situation on the ground requires it, emphasizing that the U.S. will not seek military action that will support one sector over another. And above all, Iraqi leaders must rise above their differences and come together around a political plan for Iraq's future. Imad Haduri, an Iraqi nuclear scientist who worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 to 1998 and is the author of Iraq's Nuclear Mirage, Memoirs and Delusions, joins us to discuss the General Military Council for Iraqi Revolutionaries, the Sunni umbrella group he asserts is really directing the military operation that is being attributed to ISIS, and what his contacts inside that group are telling him as the Sunni rebels, having reached the outskirts of Baghdad, are poised to attack the city. Then, as Russia resumes its military buildup near Ukraine's eastern border, we will speak with Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico Military Affairs at the State Department during the George H.W. Bush administration. He has an article at The National Interest, What If Russia Invades Ukraine?, and we will discuss what can be learned from the history of U.S. confrontations with Russia and the USSR and the extent to which Putin's use of armed surrogates who are destabilizing Ukraine's eastern provinces is being sufficiently successful that further Russian military involvement may not be necessary. Then finally, we will speak with Matthew Rothschild, the senior editor of The Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin, about newly released court documents from prosecutors that allege Governor Scott Walker engaged in a criminal scheme to violate state election law by improperly coordinating campaign activities with outside groups. We will discuss an email from Governor Walker to Karl Rove that was released by the appeals court in which Walker appears to brag about his involvement and the role of R.J. Johnson, the director of Wisconsin's Club for Growth, saying, bottom line, R.J. helps keep in place a team that is wildly successful in Wisconsin. We are running 9 recall elections, and it will be like running 9 congressional markets in every market in the state, including the Twin Cities. And joining us now is Imad Haduri, who's an Iraqi nuclear scientist who worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 until 1998. And in late 1998, he left Iraq with his family and now teaches and works as a network administrator in Toronto, Canada, and is the author of Iraq's Nuclear Mirage, Memoirs and Delusions, and he blogs at Free Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Imad Haduri.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have since moved to Doha, Qatar, where I'm now working, actually.
Well, you're certainly in the region, and I imagine that people have been watching President Obama's press conference today, where he announced that he will send up to 300 military advisors to Iraq, help to retrain Iraqi security forces, but U.S. armed forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq. What kind of game do you think Obama's playing here, trying to leverage Maliki to do what Maliki should have done years ago, which is form an inclusive government? Do you think it's too late? And what do you think is going on now in terms of, I imagine behind the scenes, they're trying to get rid of Maliki, aren't they?
Yes, yes. And it is too late, actually, to send 300 people now at the 11th hour to train soldiers and policemen who, after 11 years, haven't been trained enough, as if in 1, 2, 3 days they can train them enough to not to drop their guns and throw their clothes, military clothes, and run away. This is really too late. But I'm not sure if these 300 are the same as the 275 who are being sent to protect the 5,000 Americans at the American embassy in Baghdad. So if it is, then that's now 575, if it is not the same force. But we have seen, and I've put on my blog that you mentioned, for Iraq, just 2 days ago, how the Americans were actually training the police with obscene words, with sectarian innuendos. They were insulting them, this American GI or officer, whatever. And in a training session with a translator, he was really heaping a lot of bull on these policemen, and he expects them to be trained. So there's a lot of animosity, not only by the training of the Americans. Let's be clear. They are not there to train anybody. They are there to eavesdrop, to give military intelligence to the Maliki or not. But they are no way they can train now the army and police who have completely sort of broken down. And we really wonder how that happened, by the way. In Mosul, overnight, the three top military police and so forth generals, on notice, in a sense, called their subordinates, 30, 40,000 of them, soldiers, police, and forces, so special forces, and they told them, drop your clothes, run away. And then, within an hour or two, they take a convoy of military vehicles and they go to Erbil, to the Kurds. Now, with all the rife bribery going on in Iraq for the past 11 years, huge amounts, I'm not talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions, I'm talking about billions, tens of billions of dollars that have gone down the funnel of corruption. Is it possible that these three top generals who simply deserted their responsibility, deserted Mosul, were bribed by the Kurds? And the payback is that the Kurds overtook Kirkuk, which was split half control Arab and Iraqi and half control Kurdish. And Kirkuk is the oil-rich capital of the north. And suddenly the Kurds are there now. And they say, we're not going to move away. So the whole thing stinks, smells of bribery, of cowardice. This is on top of the disfranchising that Nouri Maliki has been exercising over the Iraqi, half of the Iraqi population, those who are not Shiite of his sect. And he's so blatant about it. He's so clear about this. He is reviving this very old sectarian animosities. In a speech about 2 months ago, in the memory of one of the events called Ashura, he said, we are going to fight Yazid. This fight happened 1,300 years ago when this guy Yazid attacked the Shiites in Iraq. And now this guy wants to revenge that 1,300 years ago by attacking the Sunnis, defranchising them, putting them in jail. Mm. They had peaceful demonstrations. He obliterated that with violence. He killed 42 people in Hawija near Kirkuk, and in Ramadi and Fallujah, he destroyed all the camps. After 1 year of patiently demonstrating, demanding to be heard, to be equally treated. So all this disfranchising of the Sunnis has bred a deep-seated animosity and has led to a sort of a revolution, you can call. And it's not only the Sunnis who have repulsed, by the way. I will just transgress back in time. After the second attack on the peaceful demonstrations in Ramadi and Fallujah, after Hawija, there sprung up, apparently, a group. They call themselves the General Military Council for the Iraqi revolutionaries. And they, in secret, of a whole year, they apparently attracted and convinced and mobilized many of the Iraqi resistance factions. And there are many. There is the Ba'athists under Naqshbandiya with Izzat al-Duri, the ex-vice president. There are the Muslim Brotherhoods, Ikhwan al-Sunnah, there are, and so on. And there are even Christian militias, there are Kurdish, not militias, resistance fighters, Kurdish, Turkmen. Anyway, this group, the General Military Command, the General Military Council, apparently managed to unite all of them over a whole year in secret. And as soon as they announced themselves, which was January 24th, 2014, about 5 months ago, it became apparent to us when we read their declaration of announcing themselves, these people are professionals. These are professional military. They are professional intelligence. And they are, we immediately guessed they were remnants of the previous regime who paid a lot of attention to intelligence and to the military. So within a week after they announced themselves, by the end of January, lo and behold, 70 cells in all of Iraq, from the north, from the south, Shiite, Kurds, Christians, women, when they videotaped announcement, they said they are now part of this general military council. I have that on my blog on the date, I think, January 29th, the date, with all the 70 videos of all these dormant cells have been organized by this general military council. Now, we recognize that this is a very potential revolutionary force indeed, and under very experienced and professional leadership. Then we were surprised in March, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, when suddenly in Fallujah, which Daesh has, this ISIS, we call them Daesh, they had entered Iraq from Syria and they attacked Ramadi, Fallujah, but then we thought it was under the hands, under the control of the General Military Council. But then we see that the ISIS, I would call them now, so that we don't confuse them, they had a parade in Fallujah with their pickups, with their black flags and black-dressed women. So we asked the leadership of the General Military Council, why do you allow these people to be called revolutionaries? We know very well they are not. They are a fundamentalist Islamic Qaeda group. You are the revolutionaries. Why do you allow the press and the media to spotlight on them and you're keeping quiet? Well, this was part of their covert planning. And they did respond to me, and it's again on my blog post, on my blog, and they said, look, they requested to go on a car demonstration in Fallujah. I said, go ahead. But if you notice in the video, the people weren't paying attention. They didn't applaud, they didn't support, they just looked at them. And when they left, by the way, the helicopters came and they decimated that convoy of military pickups. But they asked for this and we allowed them. Now, this is a big point. When they say allowed them, it means they are also in coordination with them, that the ISIS is under the control of the General Military Council. Anyway, what happened was in Mosul 10 days ago, the attack and the evaporation of these three military, top military generals, the first people who entered were actually ISIS. They seemed to be the spearhead or the icebreaker or, you know, the guys who just break through. But then, not more than 1 or 2 hours to make sure that all the army, the soldiers have deserted, left, they withdrew. And in comes these revolutionaries, the Iraq revolutionaries, the General Council, Military Council. And they took over the city, not only Mosul, one more than 40% of Iraq. Now, the men who are controlling these areas are not Daesh. They're only maybe about 1,000, they estimated. And they go around opening all these other cities. But who's left behind are the Iraqi revolutionaries under the command of the General Military Council. Now, men, and they end up, and the important thing also to note, within 2 days after Mosul fell, the General Military Council named an experienced previous Ba'athist administrator as the governor of the city of Mosul. Now, had ISIS been in control or on command of the whole operation, they wouldn't have called him that, the governor of the city of Mosul. They would have called him the wali of Wilayat al-Mosul. To them, in the fundamentalist terminology, wali is the governor, and wilaya is the city, as they did in Syria. they announced Wali of Wilayat, so-and-so. But here, it was the governor in Arabic, Iraq Arabic, of city of Mosul. And the same applied in Tikrit. So this confirms that the military, the general military council is in control of all these Iraqi resistance groups as well as Daesh, and brings up a big question mark, which I refer back to the March event. How are you going to deal with them when this thing is over, when you, let's say, get to Baghdad or even more than Baghdad? How are you going to handle Daesh? The Iraqi people don't like Daesh. They despise them. They don't at all go along with them. And Daesh does not have enough force, military force, manpower, to control the Iraqi animosity to them. They simply cannot do it. They are greatly outnumbered. And it's not only a city or two. They are talk about half of Iraq. Now, that's about 50 million people. They just cannot do it. But how are they going to get rid of them? This is a big question. The other big question for the military, General Military Council, what is your position when the Kurds took Kirkuk, which is supposed to be also under the Iraqi government? Now it's completely under the Kurdish government, with the oil-rich fields there. And the third, and the third thing, a very explosive, very bloody issue, is this call of Sistani, the Shiite head clerk, to bear arms and go to fight the young people. They go to Baghdad one day training, maybe not by the 300 Americans who were there, but by the Iranians. Iranians are heavily present in Iraq, in the south of Iraq. And he asked them to go and fight the ISIS and this revolution that's coming to Baghdad. And the trigger for the very bloody issue is, Iran is claiming it, that they want to preserve the shrines, the Shiite shrines, in Samarra, which is only 100 kilometers north of Baghdad. And ISIS and the Military General Command Council are on the outskirts of that city, and in Najaf and Karbala. Iran claims we're going to send even the revolutionary force, the Revolution Corps, to fight if they attack these shrines. The ominous thing is, our sources say, somebody from Witness in Samarra, he sent an SOS. He said, look, there was a street that was always closed next to the shrine. They opened it. The military, the Maliki military, opened it. They allowed a truck to go in. It was completely covered. We don't know what's inside the truck, and it's by the walls of the shrine. That's a perfect setup for a black flag operation.
A clandestine operation, or false flag is actually what I think you meant.
False flag, yes, yeah. False flag.
Right. Well, let me again introduce you, though, Imad. I'm speaking with Imad Haduri, who is an Iraqi nuclear scientist who worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 till 1998 and left Iraq with his family. He now is working in Doha, Qatar, and is the author of Iraq's Nuclear Mirage, Memoirs and Delusions, and he now writes the Free Iraq blog. So given that the tactic, you've made it pretty clear, and this is why I find it pretty extraordinary that the United States would consider bombing. And you have to recognize, I think, about the kind of pressure that Obama's under from the political right, from the neocons who got everything wrong, and somehow now the American press has let them back in to pontificate. And, you know, he's probably being forced to do something, but it makes no sense. You can't distinguish between ISIS and the real force as you have outlined it, and it appears to me that of course we are perhaps even returning to the original Al-Qaeda strategy from 9/11, which was always to draw the Americans in. So doesn't the nature of this new civil war, if that's what it is, change if the Americans get involved? Is that the tactic that's going on here?
Well, there are two ways to get involved. The first one is by sending this aircraft carrier, the appropriately called Bush, J.W. Bush, with its airplanes and the smart bombs, who are they going to hit? There are no tanks. There are no buildings. There are no command centers. There are people on the ground. There are people in the desert. There are people in the villages who are fighting and are taking over. Who are they going? These planes going to hit? That's one thing. They are very ineffective. It's only a show of force. There's nothing more. Now, will the administration send boots on the ground, as they call it? I doubt it very much. I doubt it really very much. The American soldiers know how vicious and tough the Iraqis are. They have lost already 4,300 over a period of 7 years. And they're going to lose much more if they come this time. Because every now realize it was the fault of the United States that we have ended up in this mess. And the anger is really mounting. And by the way, it will not be forgotten soon. Whatever the consequences will be, the future will be, this will remain a sore spot. And I will not say more on this. So they will not dare send troops. What we are afraid of is that Iran will be sending troops. And there's some kind of coordination between Iran and the United States, finally in the open, apparently behind scenes all the time, we think. But now if Iran sends boots on the ground, that's a completely different matter. Then it's not only the United States concerned, then there'll be the Arab states next to Iraq that will be concerned. And they might also interfere, no matter what the states say, because they will be threatened by that. Very threatened. So it's a very messy issue. The other mess, which I cannot understand, it is eyewitnesses and people on the ground have told us that once Mosul was captured within a few hours and the army left, the revolutionaries and this ISIS took over the military warehouses full of American weapons, light, medium, heavy. And immediately Daesh assigned a certain percentage of his people to load the trucks and drive them the same day to Syria across the west. It's not very far, 5 hours. And the same happened in Tikrit when they took over Tikrit a few days later. Again, Daesh took most of the bounty, let's say, military bounty, American military bounty, sent it to Syria. Now, the dilemma is this. The Syrian resistance appealed to the General Military Council of Iraq, said, look, this weaponry that's coming to Syria is against us. ISIS is not fighting al-Assad, hasn't fought the Assad. ISIS is fighting us. But yet, ISIS in Iraq is fighting al-Maliki. We don't understand this. ISIS in Syria is against the resistance in Syria. ISIS in Iraq is under the leadership of the Iraqi resistance. What the hell is going on? We have no idea.
Well, isn't there a logical explanation, though, in terms of ISIS's motives for bringing that equipment into Syria, and that is the safest area for them, right? The U.S. and Iran, for that matter, is more likely to bomb inside Iraq than they are inside Syria.
Well, if they're going to bomb, it means the warehouses. Well, they can just take the content and they can disperse it all over.
Right.
It doesn't have to be in one single place. No, this is not the case.
Right.
No, it is really that they are preparing to attack the other Syrian factions, resistance factions. That's the big worry.
And they're playing right into Assad's hands, as you say.
Yes.
But then since Assad is being protected by both Russia and Iran, what would Iran's motives be in this case?
That's another puzzle, another question. And yet ISIS is attacking Maliki's dominance directly, head on. And then I don't advise Obama to sell Iraq any more ammunition to be sent over. He'll be simply handing it over to ISIS and to the Iraqi revolutionaries if he sends any more munitions. Already he has lost everything he has sent.
Right.
$27 billion has cost the Iraqi government to buy armaments and munitions from the United States. $27 billion, I'm talking. And also to train the Iraqis, supposedly. All gone within a few hours. three generals just deserted.
Well, just in closing, Imad, we've run out of time, but I'm interested in what you think might be the next stage here in this, because we are poised for another round of civil war. A lot of analysts are saying that the country could disintegrate, balkanize, etc. What do you see happening here, assuming that the U.S. doesn't escalate and Obama's good to his word that he doesn't want to get too deeply involved and wants Maliki to go?
Okay, yes. Maliki will be gone, either by escape with his family in an airplane or is going to hit the dirt. But there are two scenarios. If the revolutionaries occupy only Baghdad and they manage not to blow any shrine, especially in Samarra, they take over, that'll prove that point, that they are not sectarian. If they only reach Baghdad and don't move south, then it'll be a division, Iraq in three sections. But if they do move south to go and take Najaf and Karbala, despite Iran and Iran's forces, and with the support of the Arab Shiite tribes in the south, and there are many of them, and they are just really under the boot of Maliki now, if they do manage to capture also Karbala and Najaf, and even Basra, which is the hardest nut to crack, then it'll be Iraq. It'll remain Iraq. And then we'll have to deal with the Kurds separately. But if they stop at Baghdad, that's a scenario for division. And we'll see. But I expect tomorrow's Friday, right? Yeah, tomorrow's Friday. You might be hearing some news tomorrow. It's in the pipeline coming to us. We'll see.
What kind of news? Just you're being tantalizing here.
Well, before the attack on Mosul, I was talking with one of my contacts in Mosul a week before, and he just said, oh, wait until 1 week, then we'll be there. I said, what do you mean we'll be there? There are 30, 40,000 soldiers and policemen. He said, no, we're going to be there. A week later, lo and behold, within a few hours, they're there. I talked to him yesterday, 2 days ago, again. And he said, oh, okay, by Friday, in Baghdad. I said, what, you kidding? I said, just wait, we'll see. That's what I mean.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Imad Haduri.
Well, I thank you for calling again, because 10 years or 11 years earlier, you did also interview me.
I remember, yes.
Yeah, there are no weapons of mass destruction. This is all lies. Don't be dragged into Iraq, and rivers of blood will flow.
Right.
Maybe with you or another station. And then
I remember very well. I was one of the few journalists in the United States who predicted that the Iraq war would be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. And everybody was cheering and buying into this insanity at the time. So I know I'm sounding like I'm tooting my own horn here, but I did get that right.
I thank you for interviewing me, because at the time when I said rivers of blood will, at the time before the occupation of Iraq, 2003 in February, I said, I am talking with you, Ian, with like bullets in my words. I felt so emotional about it. But wait till you get to Iraq and occupy it. Then you'll get real bullets and rivers of blood will flow. What happens? Somebody in Florida, some American, calls the FBI and told them and tells them there's somebody threatening the security. Yes, in Canada. So the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they came to me to my university, dragged me out. Why do you say rivers of blood will flow? I looked at them. I said, look, I'm Iraqi. I know my people. Whoever, and rivers of blood will flow. I assure you. That was before the occupation, and it did. And now we're going to see some more rivers of blood, especially with the sectarian amplification by this guy Sistani, who asked his youth, emotional youth, to pick up arms and go and fight. Good Lord. If that really happens, especially if they manage to blow up the shrine, that's going to be knee-deep blood, knees deep.
Well, Imad Haduri, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Imad Haduri, who's an Iraqi nuclear scientist who worked with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Commission from 1968 until 1998. And in 1998, he left Iraq with his family. He now teaches and works in Doha, Qatar, and is the author of Iraq's Nuclear Mirage, Memoirs and Delusions. And he also writes the Free Iraq blog. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into Russia's military buildup near Ukraine's eastern border.
The second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation. What is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of and editor of a number of books on international politics, including Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy and Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at the National Interest, What If Russia Invades Ukraine? Welcome to Background Briefing, Bennett Ramberg.
Thank you again.
And, of course, the discussion at the moment is, will the U.S. Get involved militarily in Iraq again? And the president had a press conference today suggesting that there'd be no boots on the ground, but there might be airstrikes and a limited number of special forces. But meanwhile, on the Ukrainian border, there's another Russian military buildup that NATO says is not to do with securing the border to stop the smuggling of tanks, etc., but rather a offensive military deployment. So my first question to you would be, why would Russia need to invade Ukraine when, in fact, they're successfully destabilizing it through their surrogates? You know, it's kind of like a mafia operation. They're just putting the screws on and making the Ukrainian government feel the pain until they relent and perhaps, you know, give autonomy to the eastern regions.
Well, Ian, this appears to be a policy of intimidation, trying to intimidate the new Ukrainian government so they would bend to whatever Russia ultimately wants to do. It appears that the Russians are continuing to infiltrate material, equipment, and perhaps even forces into Ukraine. And you have the rebels in Ukraine that are contesting the government, contesting control of the Ukrainian government in the eastern part of the country. And how far this goes, and frankly, in the West at least, so nobody knows. The only person who frankly does know, and maybe he doesn't even know, is Vladimir Putin, how far he wants to push this.
Well, in your article, of course, you trace the history of U.S. presidents faced with what to do about Russia's moves on Czechoslovakia, on Hungary, on East Berlin, on Afghanistan. And, of course, during the Cold War, with all those nuclear weapons pointing at each other, I mean, the reason we had a Cold War was we couldn't afford to have a hot war. So, you know, it sort of was kabuki theater, wasn't it? There wasn't an awful lot we could do.
Well, it wasn't entirely kabuki theater because part of the Cold War was fought by surrogates. We found that in Afghanistan when the Russians intervened, and we used surrogates in Afghanistan. And the Russians arguably used surrogates in the case of the Korean War and the Vietnam War. There's some who believe the Russians or the Soviet Union greenlit North Korea's intervention during the Korean War. And in the case of Vietnam, clearly the Russians provided, or the Soviet Union provided, material assistance to the North Vietnamese. You may remember the bombing of Haiphong Harbor, where there were Soviet ships in the harbor, and there was concern that this could create a major incident. So clearly surrogates were fought But the U.S. and the Russians, fortunately, never came to blows in those particular cases. But there's really four categories of contest between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. There was the massive use of force by the U.S. in Korea and Vietnam. During the cases of revolts in East Germany in 1953, Hungary in 1956, and Czechoslovakia in 1968, the United States adopted a policy of what I call gawking and pouting. We would beat our chest, say things. The president of the United States at the time would go out and make an address to the American people, but nothing would happen. In the case, most recent case, or let's go to Afghanistan. In the case of Afghanistan, which Jimmy Carter thought was a threat to the vital oil resources in the Persian Gulf. That was his perception. The United States provided support for the Mujahideen to contest the Soviets in Afghanistan, in addition to sanctions, economic sanctions. You may remember what we did with regard to the Olympics. We boycotted those Olympics. And most recently was the case of Georgia, where you had Russian troops intervene into Georgia. This was prompted, actually, by the Georgian government, and the Bush administration had to address the issue of what do we do? And there was a lot of consternation in the National Security Council meeting concerning Georgia, and a lot of, apparently, according to Condoleezza Rice's memoirs, a lot of breastfeeding, that we should do something to stop the Russians. And then Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, said, interrupted the conferees, and he said, do we really want to fight a war over Georgia with Russia? People calmed down, and that conflict was resolved diplomatically.
Well, now you could, I'm sure if that same meeting were taking place in the National Security Council today, you know, somebody would probably say that, if not Obama himself. You know, do you really want a war with Russia?
I believe so. And as a consequence, the United States has been very leery to do too much, as well as the Europeans. You know, we've asserted or we've inflicted some very, very modest sanctions against the Russians, very, very modest. And the president in Europe recently announced what he called the European Reassurance Initiative, in which he agreed to bolster the training and support of some of NATO's East Flank members that face Ukraine and further east, the Russians. And, however, we don't intend to place permanent forces there. Rather, we plan to rotate forces in and out of the area so we don't incite the Russians. This is the presumption. But there'll be more training to, as the initiative says, reassure our allies.
So, again, I'm speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico and Military Affairs in the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author and editor of a number of books on international politics, including Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy and Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at the National Interest, What If Russia Invades Ukraine? But the one case, though, of Hungary is an interesting case, because I actually years ago talked with Arthur Macy Cox, who was the CIA station chief there, and he was having direct negotiations with his KGB counterpart in Budapest, who at the time was Yuri Andropov, who later became the general secretary of, the head of the Soviet Union. And they worked a deal that the Russians would allow this Hungarian democratic government, or this insurgent government, to form a government, and that they would back down quietly. And then guess what happened? The British and the French and the Israelis invaded the Suez Canal.
Right.
And that blew the deal and gave the Russians the cover to renege. And the very people on the Hungarian side that they'd agreed to meet with were all rounded up and killed.
That indeed, and many, many people were killed, and during that revolution. It's interesting with regard to Eisenhower's thought about Hungary and, frankly, Eastern Europe. Prior to the entry of the Eisenhower administration into power, John Foster Dulles talked in the late 1940s about rollback of Soviet forces in or Soviet presence rather in Eastern Europe, and when they entered office. Dulles was Secretary of State, and the hubris confronted reality. And although there were meetings in the National Security Council discussing what we ought to do or revolts to occur, at first the reaction was, well, we shouldn't do too much because that would incite things and involve us. And then at the same time, we, according to now formerly classified National Security Council documents, there were those who proposed that we should do more. We should support the people in the event of an uprising. But there was still concern about reprisals. There was a good deal of confusion. And at the end of the day, when reality confronted the administration, what I say, gawked and pouted. That's what they did, as in the case of Czechoslovakia, which was a different setting. When the Russians intervened in Czechoslovakia, Lyndon Johnson was really miffed. He was miffed because he planned an arms control, a meeting with the Russians to talk about the strategic arms control. And because of the Russian invasion, that had to be put off. And one of the initiatives that he wanted to end his administration with came to an end.
So there's always been bigger fish to fry, haven't there? I mean, that's is that the lesson of history here?
Yes, that's the lesson. That's one of the lessons of history, I would say, yeah.
But so in the current situation, with the U.S. distracted, with Iraq, with Putin holding all the cards, there doesn't seem to be a lot that can be done. I mean, on June the 27th, the new leader of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, has said that he's going to sign the EU agreement.
That's right.
And Putin's never been very happy about that. So I assume that he's going to turn up the screws. He's already, you know, I mean, he's already got Poroshenko to call on the Ukrainian army to halt for some sort of amnesty for the rebels. He had a long conversation with Putin about it, but it looks like Putin is just turning the screws no matter what. You know, he's doing both, playing the good cop and the bad cop.
Evidently he is. So then the question arises, what would happen, you know, if the Russians actually invade? This is what my article looks at, looking at the issue in the context of history. So what ought the United States do in that event? Mind you, when the Russians invaded Crimea, the Ukrainians didn't respond. So what ought the United States do? So as I look at the models of the past, I find that if the Ukrainians are willing to fight, we could do what we did in Afghanistan, that is provide the Ukrainians with the military material, which we could provide through the Polish border, for example, to contest the Russians, were they to actually intervene. I think, however, the better option is the Georgian option. That is, we try to reach a diplomatic accommodation. I don't think we're able to change what's happened in Crimea. However, if we could reach some sort of accommodation where the Ukrainians stay out of NATO, have some sort of mixed relationship between the EU and the Russians, that we reach a diplomatic agreement that, unfortunately, Crimea will remain with Russia, as Abkhazia and South Ossetia did in the case of Georgia, and that we have to face the realities in that regard, and that Ukraine remain kind of Finlandized, if you will.
Well, just in closing there, Bennett Ramberg, it looks as though, as I mentioned in the beginning, that Putin doesn't have to invade. He's doing pretty well by just turning the screws through his surrogates in the east, destabilizing Ukraine, causing them a lot of pain, until Putin will have some autonomy over the eastern region, which seems to be his ultimate goal.
You may well be right. However, if the violence increases and the surrogates request, demand that the Russians do something to help them in the situation of whatever the situation goes towards, how would the Russians respond? This is something we don't know. I don't even know if Vladimir Putin knows. No. But there remains the plausibility, the possibility that you could have the intervention of some actual ground forces. But is that remote? I can't answer that question. But it's something I think we should think about and look at history and the models of history pose.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Bennett Ramberg.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico and Military Affairs in the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author and editor of a number of books on international politics, including Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy and Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at the National Interest, What If Russia Invades Ukraine?
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the smoking gun from prosecutors in Wisconsin alleging that Governor Scott Walker engaged in a criminal scheme. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Rothschild, who's the senior editor of The Progressive magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin. He is one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in the country and is the author of You Have No Right, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rothschild.
Well, thanks for having me back, Ian. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise, Matthew, and it looks as though your governor, Scott Walker, might be in trouble. He, according to prosecutors in Wisconsin, he has been described as being the center of a scheme to violate state election laws by improperly coordinating campaign activities with outside groups. So what kind of a bombshell is this?
Oh, it's a big bombshell, and it's still exploding around the Capitol here in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's damaging, very damaging to Scott Walker, both in terms of his re-election campaign, which is this November, and his grandiose ambitions to run for president of the United States, if you can believe that. And so what this document dump revealed today was that Scott Walker was indeed and has been indeed the target of this John Doe investigation that's been going on for more than a year now in Wisconsin. And he's at the center of it. He is alleged to have been working illegally with some outside conservative groups to protect him and defend him against the recall campaign, which he won. And there's a document from Scott Walker himself to Karl Rove, of all people, saying that Walker's one of his chief deputies is, coordinating 9 recall elections or campaigns in every market of the state, and he's asking Karl Rove for help in that. And so here you have evidence, real smoking gun evidence, that the governor of Wisconsin was trying to circumvent the election laws of Wisconsin and the federal government, for that matter, which says you can't coordinate with outside groups. Now, this is up in the air now after a recent Supreme Court decision and also after a recent federal judge, a real right-winger in Wisconsin, put this investigation on hold. But the prosecutors have released some of the documents, and we got one of those today with this message from Walker to Karl Rove himself.
And the message refers to R.J. Johnson, who directed and ran the Wisconsin Club for Growth, which is one of these social welfare tax-exempt groups, and specifically the memo from Scott Walker to Karl Rove says, bottom line, R.J. helps keep in place a team that is wildly successful in Wisconsin. We are running 9 recall elections, and it will be like running 9 congressional markets in every market in the state and the Twin Cities. So that certainly appears that Scott Walker's fingerprints are on this. It's not as if he can deny that he's involved, surely.
Yeah, his fingerprints are all over this, just as they were all over a previous John Doe investigation, which he just managed to elude indictment on. This one, it's unclear whether there's going to be an indictment or not, depending on an appeal of this right-wing judge's decision to halt this investigation. But you can see why the investigators were hot on Scott Walker's trail, and you can see why Scott Walker himself, even after the judge suspended the investigation, has been trying to reach an agreement on the side with the prosecutors, because he knows he's in a world of hurt here, and he wants to put this whole thing behind him, not only for his political ambitions, but now for his, his freedom.
Well, but what's interesting here is that the prosecutor is a Republican. You say this right-wing judge in Milwaukee is the one who stymied the investigation, but then these documents were released by the appeals court, right? That is looking into this decision of this right-wing judge.
That's correct. The appeals court released these documents. And they got most of the people to agree to release the documents, except now there's this right-wing counterattack by some Koch brothers-related groups that have been alleged to be working in coordination with the Walker campaign back during the recall, who now want everything to be secret. And so they're suing everybody in sight, and including, you know, the prosecutors and the Government Accountability Board here, which handles election financing reporting, and, you know, they're desperate. The right wing is absolutely desperate here that Scott Walker may be taken down.
So just to give our audience a sort of layman's view here of what exactly was done here, or appears to have been done here by Scott Walker and his team during the recall, what's the smoking gun and what's the law that he's broken?
Well, the smoking gun is that he, according to his own email, was working with a person who was... he was talking to Karl Rove, and he was working with an old associate, R.J. Johnson, who was then with an so-called outside campaign group. There's not supposed to be coordination between the campaign and outside groups. The outside groups are allowed to spend unlimited amount of money so long as they don't coordinate with the candidate or the candidate's campaign. Here they're coordinating with the candidate himself, and that's a huge problem. That's against the law.
So, again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who is the senior editor of the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in the country, and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. So, having successfully dodged a number of bullets, I mean, Scott Walker somehow recovered from that extraordinary phone conversation, the sting, if you will, where he was caught talking to an actor or somebody posing as one of the Koch brothers. That you would have thought would have been sufficiently humiliating, but nevertheless, he did survive the recall. Perhaps he survived the recall because of some of this chicanery, right? There's no question that tons of money poured in to Scott Walker's coffers.
Oh, yeah, and he's going to have tons of money again running for re-election here in November, and if he chooses to run for president, he'd have tons of money. But he's got to get out from under this cloud if he's got a chance for any kind of political future, and this cloud all of a sudden has gotten a lot darker today and a lot more dangerous for him, and we all can see now in Wisconsin and around the country why these prosecutors have been, you know, tracking him so closely.
And what's the role of his chief of staff? Because he seemed to have been the original target, and now, of course, it's moved on to Walker himself. So who is he and what's going on with him?
Well, I'm not exactly sure on that one, but Walker has this group of close associates for many years, dating back to the time he was Milwaukee County executive. And these people have been carrying all sorts of dirty water for him for years and have been on the wrong side of the law. Many former Walker aides have been convicted of felonies, five or six of them, because of the illegal work that they were doing on his behalf. And so... you know, he's just got this terrible network of people who don't really care about the law. They're lawbreakers. And he surrounded himself with them, and I would think that people would take note of that.
So who's this group then, Friends of Scott Walker, who the Scott Walker, his press people are deflecting any questions on this breaking story today to Friends of Scott Walker?
Well, they want to get at least half an arm's length between Scott Walker and these allegations, but they can't get a fingernail's distance between them because they got Walker himself saying in an email that he's coordinating with outside groups. So it's a real problem for him. Of course, if you were a staffer for Scott Walker today, you'd be backpedaling absolutely as fast as you possibly can, but it's not going to get him out of this right now, I don't think.
And this email is just one of a lot of stuff that was released by these prosecutors today or because of the appeals court, right? That was the means by which it was released.
Yeah, and there may be other bombs to go off. We haven't looked at all those documents yet, nor has the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that's done most of the path-breaking reporting on this story to date.
So when do you think any other shoes are going to drop? I mean, at this point, we're not talking about any criminal indictments. This is still an ongoing inquiry. It certainly already has the whiff of political damage, surely.
Yeah, this is a real damaging political day for Scott Walker. Not so much a problem legally today because this right-wing judge has suspended the investigation, but a real fastball to, beanball to his head here because of the dropping of this email. This is really jeopardizing Scott Walker's political future here, both in his chance to run for governor, and he's in neck and neck with his Democratic opponent here, and I imagine she's going to gain some ground on this, and it may just kill his presidential ambitions right in his tracks.
But will this appeals court, in other words, can you change jurisdiction? Obviously, they chose the jurisdiction of this right-wing judge to quash this inquiry. But can the appeals court or can some other legal entity circumvent this judge and, try it before a different court?
Well, certainly an appellate judge can throw, the appellate court can throw out the ruling by the right-wing judge, and the prosecutors in this John Doe investigation can continue. And if they're allowed to continue, they can bring indictments. So he's not free and clear legally, and he's certainly not free and clear politically.
And what's your sense then of the local mood there? Because it's a very divided state, Wisconsin, and it's in Madison itself, the capital. It's like almost like enemy territory for Scott Walker. I mean, almost every other bumper sticker you see driving around Madison is recall Scott Walker. So from where you sit, what's the local mood?
Well, and I'm sitting four blocks from the Capitol, and I'm going to have to run in 1 second. But the mood among people who realize how horrible Scott Walker's been, the mood is pretty jubilant today. But I got to run now. Sorry, Ian.
No worries. Thank you so much, Matthew.
No problem. Take care.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's senior editor of the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin. He is one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.